Radio EcoShock.
People in many parts of the world are suffering through extreme heat. The hottest year so far was 2023. The heat is still rolling in 2024 on land and sea. Scientists are scrambling to find out why. One of the top science journals in the world, Nature, just published this article, "Climate Models Can't Explain 2023's Huge Heat Anomaly. We could be in uncharted territory." The author is the director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, Gavin Schmidt. Since taking over from James Hansen in 2014, Schmidt continues research with peer-reviewed publications galore and still makes time to communicate. From New York, Gavin Schmidt, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much for having me.
You make climate predictions every year. How did last year's forecast work out?
Yeah, it was a total bust. We do that every year. We've been doing it for about a decade now. And the biggest two determinants of what is going to happen in any one particular year is the long-term trend, which is being driven by the rise in greenhouse gases for the most part. And then some of the ups and downs on top of that trend are driven by the pattern of warming and cooling in the tropical Pacific. That's called El Nino, La Nina. And so based on that, you generally do a pretty good job of predicting how any one year is going to go. You know, we were able to predict that 2016 was going to be a record warm year because it was starting off with an El Nino event, which is the warm phase. We were able to predict that, say, 2019 was going to be relatively cool, below trend, because of the La Ninas that had started. But at the beginning of 2023, we were in a La Nina event, the tail end, but still at the cool phase. And that would generally not indicate that we were going to be in a record warm year. And yet, by the summer, we were seeing record warm temperatures in the North Atlantic, record warm temperatures in the oceans overall. We were starting to see record low sea ice in Antarctica, the other side of the world. And that just kind of kept on going until by September, October, November, we were seeing records being broken by record-breaking margins in ways that we had never really seen in the data before or anticipated because of through climate modeling. And so we ended up with the warmest year on record by a record-breaking margin, and we didn't really have a great explanation for why.
That was really a shocker when the sea ice collapsed around Antarctica. I mean, it had been expanding around the South Pole until at least 2012, despite global warming, and then something changed, something switched. Do we know what?
So that's actually a very interesting technical thing. So actually, it was rising through to about 2015, and we've done some work on that, looking at what the impacts of the melting ice shelves and melting ice on the continent might be doing to the freshwater budget of the Southern Ocean, and we think that actually might have led to some of that rise. But what's happened since 2015, we saw a very sharp decline in 2016, 2017, a little bit of a recovery, and then this year it was way, way lower than anything that we had seen. So it was missing about 1 million square kilometers of ice, which is quite a lot. It's not a total collapse of the ice, but it is quite a large anomaly.
At the other end of the Earth, a recent study by Chad Green of NASA found ice loss from Greenland has been 20% greater than previously assumed. You led a paper published in December 2023 saying glacier meltwater is now big enough to change natural systems, or as you put it, anomalous meltwater from ice sheets and ice shelves is a historical forcing. What does that mean?
So it means that it's large enough that we need to start thinking about it when we do what are called hindcasts. When you build climate models, right, what you want to do is you want to predict what's going to happen in the future, of course, but you also want to explain what happened in the past. And so we do simulations that start in the 19th century or even earlier, and then we kind of run them forward with the changes in greenhouse gases and variations in the sun or volcanoes and aerosol and air pollution and deforestation and all those kind of things. And then we try and see what we can explain from the observational record. And our point there was, we have to now, because the ice sheets are melting and depositing so much water into the ocean. We need to take that into account for both sea level, but also ocean circulation and sea ice. And in fact, it's making a, you know, it's not the biggest thing that's happening, but it is something that we need to be including.
Yeah, one of the puzzles is whether this extra seawater, the extra fresh water actually, will change the North Atlantic current called the Gulf Stream or AMOC. And right. If that were to happen, then Northern Europe and perhaps parts of New England would be colder. And that's strange to try and picture. How do we get a colder patch in a really warming world? Is that what would happen, or would the whole world cool for a little bit?
So we know that this overturning circulation that you mentioned, the AMOC, in some sense it's self-sustaining, right? So it brings warm, salty water up from the Gulf. The fact that then that cools, but it's salty, and so it sinks heavier water. And so that kind of like keeps that engine going. And if it stops, and we know that it has done for various reasons in paleoclimate terms, and we know that it's been severely disrupted by, you know, extra fresh water going in all of a sudden. And in models, it does the same thing. So we anticipate that there's a potential, I mean, people call it a tipping point, so sure. There's a potential tipping point associated with that. What we've looked at there is, you know, what are the thresholds for a tipping point? What, you know, whether, you know, things are going to change slowly or change abruptly. And it turns out that the threshold for an abrupt change is much, much larger than the actual amounts of water that we're seeing coming off Greenland at the moment. So, you know, that's not a trivial amount of water. It's about 250 gigatons of water every year is coming from Greenland and going into the surrounding oceans. But that's around, you know, like a factor of 10, a factor of 100, too small to have a major effect on the circulation, as far as we know.
Getting back to the mysterious heat spike these past 12 months, there are a few theories. Could it be the massive Hunga Tonga, Hunga Hapai volcanic eruption in the Pacific in early 2022?
Yeah, so that was a very interesting event. It was an underwater eruption, and normally volcanoes kind of cool the climate because they put up a lot of sulfur dioxide, which is the eggy smelling gas that comes out of volcanic events. And they put a lot of sulfur dioxide in the atmosphere. That turns into particles. Those particles are reflective, and so it cools the climate. But this one was quite different from any one that we've really studied in detail before, because it put up a huge amount of water vapor as well, and it went really high. The plume from this volcano went up 56 kilometers. That's over 40 miles. That was like, whoa, I've never seen that before. I mean, it's probably happened before, but we've not been in the position to see it and see it by remote sensing and satellites and planes and everything. So that was very exciting scientifically. But climatically, it turns out that water vapor in the stratosphere is a quite powerful greenhouse gas. So that's a warming effect. The sulfur dioxide is a cooling effect, and so you have this slight possible to, it could go either way, depending on which one was the larger effect. And we think that over time, it will be a warming effect, but in the early part, it will be a cooling effect. So in 2023, it's not clear that it had a big impact. And if it had an impact, it would be in the, hundredths of a degree kind of level. So that appears to be not a major contributor, but obviously it's something that we're continuing to look at.
James Hansen and Leon Simon say the spike was pushed by new regulation to cut ship emissions, leading to less cloud formation over that big Pacific shipping lane between Asia and North America. What do you think?
So we do know that there was a big cleanup in the shipping fuel that was being sold after that regulation. And so there is a decrease in emissions. The impact of that decrease in emissions on temperature is being studied as we speak. I saw a preprint of some of the results just yesterday, and lots of different modeling groups are looking at that. And it does seem to be having an effect. There does seem to be an effect there. But again, it's not huge when you look at the global mean. And so it doesn't really seem to match the temperature spikes that we saw. So it's an important candidate for what might have been going on, and maybe, you know, we need to refine that modeling, and we'll find bigger numbers. But right now, it doesn't look like that was the main driver either.
Why can't NASA measure the aerosol effect in real time?
That's an excellent question. So aerosols are very tricky to measure. And one of the things that we've been measuring is total aerosol optical depth. So that's the amount of stuff in the atmosphere. And we've had measurements of that for about 20 years. But the problem with that is that it doesn't distinguish between different kinds of aerosols. And different kinds of aerosols have different properties. So soot from biomass burning is absorbing, so that warms the climate. And sulfates from sulfur dioxide, from shipping and from volcanoes and things is reflective. There are secondary organics, these are things that kind of add to the blue haze around forests and things. There's a lot of those things. There's mineral dust from deserts. There's sea salt that's been swept up from the ocean. And there's this big whole mix of stuff that's going on. And the impacts that that has on the climate, it's very hard to tell just by knowing how much stuff there is in total. You really need to know what each individual component is doing. And until very recently, we did not have an instrument that was able to distinguish that. We have tried to do that. We had such an instrument on the Glory mission, but unfortunately, that was a successful takeoff, but it was not a successful orbital insertion, and it ended up in the South Pacific. And so that kind of set us back about a decade. We've just launched the PACE satellite, which everything seems to be checking out. We should be getting the first data from that, really in a matter of weeks. And that is going to tell us a lot more about what's happening to the aerosols and what their direct effects are. But there's still another piece of that puzzle, which is how those aerosols interact with clouds. Those are called indirect effects. And so it turns out that, if you have lots more small particles and you have a lot more small cloud droplets, that gives you a different kind of cloud than you would have had if you didn't have that. As clouds have a different lifetime, they dissipate more, they rain less. So there's all these indirect effects that give rise to things like ship tracks. So you can see these where the ships have gone by. You can often see a cloud, a contrail, if you like, behind the ship that has been created by these indirect effects. And that's still very tough science. These are all microphysical effects. It's very hard to study in a lab, and we don't have great in-situ observations. And so even when we will know how much aerosol of what kind is in the atmosphere, we will still have some uncertainty about how they interact with clouds and therefore what impact the net impact they will have on climate. That's a real frontier of science.
You say this 2023 temperature spike, quote, came out of the blue. Maybe our past data is not a firm enough guide for something with the word change in it. Gavin, could we have misjudged the stability of nature?
I don't really know what that means. I mean, is it possible that there are surprises in the greenhouse and that we're going to see new things that we haven't seen in the instrumental record? Absolutely. We're pushing the climate outside of the bounds of what we've observed, and we've been observing it well for the last 40, 50 years. We have reasonable observations going back 150 years. We have different kinds of observations going back millennia or even millions of years. But we are embarked on, to quote Roger Revelle, a great geophysical experiment, which we will never be able to repeat and whose outcome is uncertain. That should be of great concern to everybody.
A number of your scientific publications are about fine-tuning climate models. Is the jump in warming during 2023 and so far in 2024 outside what models predicted, and does that bother you as a model specialist?
That's a great question, but it's also a little bit of a subtle answer. So if you look at what the models that we ran, so we do these things periodically, right? So the last set of model simulations that were projecting the future were finished a couple of years ago. And if you look at what they projected, there's a spread of answers. Different models give slightly different rates of warming, and there's noise in the system, of course. And if you look at where 2023 lies within that bound, it's still within that bound. right? So if you had been looking at the climate models and said, well, you know, the real world is going to be kind of within the spread of the climate models, then you would not think that there was anything particularly concerning. But if you look at the details of what happened in 2023, you know, this starting with the La Niña, these massive record-breaking amounts in August and September and October, it turns out that that doesn't happen in these climate models. And so people have looked through that whole database, hundreds and hundreds of simulations, and they said, is there any one year in the modern period where something like that happens? And the answer is no. It seems to be unique. So that is a little concerning, and it could be because those models didn't include that aerosol change that we were just talking about. It could be that the models don't have enough noise or weather in them. It could be that we're underestimating the impacts of the volcano that you mentioned. I mean, there's a number of different ways in which we can reconcile these two things. But the reason why I wrote the piece in Nature last week is because I really wanted to flag that we don't have a resolution as yet. But it's not to say that we'll never have one. There's a lot of work that's being done right now on trying to quantify all of these different effects. But the right now, we don't have a good resolution. That should both be spurring the scientific community to dig a little bit deeper into what happened and why. But I think it's also important for the public to understand that, A, you know, we're moving into uncharted territory, and we should perhaps expect more anomalies to occur. I'm not trying to panic anybody. I'm not trying to tell anybody that that there's nothing we can do about climate change. I don't think that either of those things are true. But, you know, we don't know everything about the system. And so, you know, that means that, you know, until we can really explain 2023, you know, the predictions that we're going to have for 2024 and further, you know, you might want to have a little caveat on those for the time being.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Gavin Schmidt, climate scientist and director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. For the past 12 months, Earth has hovered around 1.5 degrees warmer than the IPCC definition of pre-industrial, the supposed danger line. Gavin, do you think temperatures could drop back down a bit in the next few years, or is this the new reality?
Well, whether we've passed such a level or not is a little bit uncertain. That we don't have perfect information about exactly what the temperature was like in 1850. There are some irreconcilable uncertainties associated with that. But the fact is that, you know, we've been warming at around 0.2, 0.25 degrees Celsius every decade. And until we really turn our emissions of carbon dioxide and methane around, we're going to continue to do so. So whether we're passing 1.5 today or in 5 years' time, we will look back and say, oh yeah, we passed 1.5.
On social media, you sometimes counter wrong or misunderstood information, sometimes coming from other scientists. You and other experienced scientists perform the same role at realclimate.com, like your post on more solar shenanigans. Why do you monitor bad science? And just as an example, briefly, what are the solar shenanigans?
So why monitor bad science or bad things? So I mean, climate is very important. I think the changes in climate are going to impact society and people and in ecosystems in very profound ways. They're already doing so, and will do so more in the years to come. And we should be clear-eyed in looking at these things. We shouldn't spend our time chasing phantoms or pretending that it isn't happening or thinking that it's the sun what done it. We have to recognize what we do know and act accordingly. There's never a shortage of people telling people things that they want to hear, right? You know, there's always somebody who's going to go around and say, oh, it's all going to be fine. Don't you worry your pretty little head about that. Don't be changing anything that would affect my bottom line. Ho, ho, ho. And they often use very bad science to justify that. And often for folks who are not well-versed in what the science actually says or the kinds of fallacies that people put together, it's sometimes hard to see why it's wrong. And so I spend a lot of time and have done for the last 20 years or so putting together you know, trying to be that kind of easy to understand reasons and explanations for why those things are not valid. I mean, this is a little technical, but there are some folks that still insist that all the warming is because of the sun, when all of the data from the sun, the satellite measurements from the sun, say that there's no big trend in solar activity, that you can't really explain it, and it's got totally the wrong fingerprints, and it just doesn't fit the data. But they insist that it does, and they were using a time series of what they were claiming was solar activity, and it turns out to have just been made up literally out of the whole cloth. That was a bit of a shock when people worked out what they'd done. And so it turns out that all of their claims are just literally just made up out of nothing, which perhaps is not that surprising. It always shocks me when people are quite so blatant in their confirmation bias.
You do not have a reputation as an alarmist. Your science please approach is one of the reasons I find your new questions about a possible climate shift even more troubling. As warming and impact speed up, is your concern heating up as well?
Well, I've been concerned for a long time, and I've been trying to share that with people for maybe 20 years. You don't need to be an alarmist to be concerned and to be alarmed. Obviously, there's more climate change now than there was 20 years ago, and in 20 years' time, there'll be more still. But I'm looking at that and looking forward. I'm not looking forward to it, but looking forward, we've been looking forward for many years, and we have been correct in our predictions. And so my concern is that we're still not acting in a manner that's commensurate with the size of the problem. I mean, like some governments are, some cities are, but mostly we're not. And so that is my concern.
The Goddard Institute was founded as a research arm for the space program. James Hansen began his career with an analysis of the atmosphere of Venus years before his focus turned back to our own planet. How big is Earth climate change in the GISS mission these days?
So GISS is not a very large part of NASA. It's part of the Goddard Space Flight Center, which is a much bigger part of NASA. Its main campus is in Greenbelt, just outside of D.C. GISS, the Goddard Institute that I run, is just a few, you know, it's about 100 odd people, and some of them are quite odd, actually. They're all mainly focused on climate, and we still work on kind of other planets as well. So the climate of Mars, climate of Venus, exoplanet, a climate of the deep past, but it's all kind of focused on climate. But it's one part of what NASA does, and NASA does a huge amount of other things, both associated with climate, but also all the other kind of things that NASA is more perhaps known for.
As we wrap up here, are there any ongoing projects or research you would like to tell listeners about?
I would say that people in the movies always ask the scientists, and the scientists always have the answers. And I just want to point out that in the real world, the scientists are the ones really digging into the questions. And we get excited when there aren't answers or where the answers are unclear. But where we have, you know, big implications for what the answers are, we are kind of like all hands on deck, trying to work out what's going on, improving the data, improving the models, improving our understanding, improving our comparisons. You know, we're engaged in literally dozens of projects that are taking different aspects of the system and trying to work out what's going on, why these things are changing, what the implications are going to be. And we're trying to come up with answers, and that's really what the scientists are doing. We're not just sitting around telling people what the truth is. We're actively researching the things that we don't know. And that's partly what makes science so interesting, but it's also a slightly different view of what scientists are actually doing than compared to what people think we're doing.
So we should phone up scientists to find out what we don't know.
That would be better, yes, I agree.
From the Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York, we have been talking with Director Gavin Schmidt. Find links to follow up in my show blog published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Gavin, thank you for sharing your valuable time with our listeners.
Thank you very much for having me. This is a great conversation.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.